Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 80, The Quirks and Rituals of Artists at Work. Reading some selections from a fascinating book, Daily Rituals, How Artists Work, as examples from writers, composers, painters, choreographers, playwrights, filmmakers, sculptors, poets, philosophers, and scientists. It's edited and with text by Mason Curry. We sometimes put artists on a pedestal, idealize and romanticize them, and this book shows that they are regular human beings with all kinds of quirks and habits and preferences, and being inspired and wrestling with their muse. This is your host, Monk. Thank you for listening. There are close to 200 bits in this book, Daily Rituals, How Artists Work. It's a fascinating study. I just read some of them, going to share some of them, a bit of a mix of writers and others. The moral of the story is there is no right way. There is finding one's way, and one can learn little bits and pieces from other people, but eventually you put together your own package. Some are very disciplined, some sort of free form, some are busy all the time and love it, some have to sort of coax the muse and try to draw the energy out of the stone, so to speak. So we'll let these speak for themselves. A lot of quotes in here, tons of footnotes. The author, from his picture, looks to be in his early 20s. Mason Curry, born in Honesdale, Pennsylvania, graduated from University of North Carolina at Asheville. Writing has appeared in Slate, Metropolis, and print. He lives in Brooklyn. And this is Alfred Knopf, publisher. That's fun to say. K-N-O-P-F, Knopf, however you pronounce it. Anywho, going to start with a personal favorite. Lived from 1881 to 1975. Perhaps the... I consider him, if you want to know anything about situation comedy, the prototype for any TV show or any situation comedy. He is the master. P.G. Wodehouse, Pelham Greenville Wodehouse. And he actually lived for a time on Long Island near West Hampton. Wodehouse wrote more than 90 books in his career, continuing to work daily even in his last decade. By then, he was living full-time at Remsenburg, the summer retreat on Long Island that he shared with his wife Ethel, their servants, 5 cats and 4 dogs. In 1971, the New Yorker's Herbert Warren visited Wodehouse at Remsenburg and noted that the author's 2 outstanding traits were his industry and his basic cheerfulness. "I seem to be rather good at adjusting to things," Wodehouse said. The 89-year-old author rose each day at 7:30 sharp and stepped out onto the back porch for the Daily Dozen, series of calisthenic exercises which he had performed every day since they were introduced in the U.S. in 1919. Then, his wife still asleep upstairs, Wodehouse fixed himself toast, coffee cake, and tea, and, as he ate, read what he called a breakfast book, a mystery novel by someone like N.G.A.I.O. Marsh or Rex Stout, or a light humorous book. Afterward, he smoked a pipe, took a short walk with the dogs, and by 9 o'clock settled down to work. Wind writes, "Wodehouse does his writing in his study, a fairly large pine-walled room on the ground floor overlooking the back garden. The principal pieces of furniture are a leather armchair for lounging and thinking, and a plain wooden desk about 3 feet by 5. On top of the desk are a dictionary, a knife for cleaning out pipes, and a bulky Royal typewriter which Wodehouse has used since 1934. His method of composition has remained virtually unchanged through the years. He does the first draft in longhand, in pencil. Then he sits down at the Royal and does a moderate amount of revising and polishing as he types. At present, his average output on a good working day is about 1,000 words, but when he was younger, it was close to 2,500. He had his most productive day in 1933 when, to his own astonishment, he knocked off the last 8,000 words of Thank You, Jeeves. Once, when he was beginning a Worcester Jeeves novel, he experimented with using a dictaphone. After he had dictated the equivalent of a page, he played it back to check it over. What he heard sounded so terribly unfunny that he immediately turned off the machine and went back to his pad and pencil." That's from the wherever Wind Wind is and Herbert Wind, and then this continues. "Lunch at home was followed at about 2 p.m. with another walk. Wodehouse's neighbor and longtime friend Guy Bolton would pick him up, and they would take an hour's constitutional with the dogs in tow. Wodehouse had to be back in his study by 3:30 for the soap opera The Edge of Night, which he never missed. At first I found that funny, but then I realized, you know, he was writing about the buffoonery and the high society, and so the soap opera would make perfect sense to feed the muse there. Then he had a traditional English tea with his wife. After this, according to the biographer Robert McCrum, he might snooze a bit in his armchair, have a bath, and do some more work before the evening cocktail. Sherry for her, a lethal martini for him. At 6, which they took in the sun parlor overlooking the garden. This was followed by dinner alone with Ethel and eaten early to allow the cook to get home to her family. After dinner, Wodehouse would usually read, but occasionally he would play two-handed bridge with Ethel, a habit he joked that doubtlessly suggested he was senile." just writing about the guy makes me chuckle. Some of the funniest stuff ever. Wonderful writing, just wonderful, wonderful writing. And let's see, we will go now to poet Maya Angelou, born 1928. "Angelou has never been able to write at home. Quote, I try to keep home very pretty, and I can't work in a pretty surrounding. It throws me." End quote. As a result, she has always worked in hotel or motel rooms, the more anonymous the better. She described her routine in a 1983 interview. "I usually get up at about 5:30 and I'm ready to have coffee by 6, usually with my husband. He goes off to work around 6:30 and I go off to mine. I keep a hotel room in which I do my work, a tiny mean room with just a bed and sometimes, if I can find it, a face basin. I keep a dictionary, a Bible, a deck of cards, and a bottle of sherry in the room. I try to get there around 7 and I work until 2 in the afternoon. If the work is going badly, I stay until 12:30. If it's going well, I'll stay as long as it's going well. It's lonely and it's marvelous. I edit while I'm working. When I come home at 2, I read over what I've written that day and then try to put it out of my mind. I shower, prepare dinner so that when my husband comes home, I'm not totally absorbed in my work. We have a semblance of a normal life. We have a drink together and have dinner. Maybe after dinner I'll read to him what I've written that day. He doesn't comment. I don't invite comments from anyone but my editor. But hearing it aloud is good. Sometimes I hear the dissonance, then I try to straighten it out in the morning. I will second that immensely, that I find reading poems, especially out loud, is essential to hearing the sound and the rhythm. And sometimes I actually will read something that is not on the page, which shows something. It continues, in this manner, Angelou has managed to write not only her acclaimed series of autobiographies, but numerous poems, plays, lectures, articles, and television scripts. Sometimes the intensity of the work brings on strange physical reactions. Her back goes out, her knees swell, and her eyelids once swell completely shut. Still, she enjoys pushing herself to the limits of her ability. I have always got to be the best, she has said. I'm absolutely compulsive. I admit it. I don't see that's a negative. And another wonderful writer, 1874 to 1965, Somerset Maugham. The Maugham thought that writing, like drinking, was an easy habit to form and a difficult one to break, Jeffrey Myers noted in his 2004 biography of the British writer. It was more an addiction than a vocation. The addiction served him well. In his nearly 92 years, Maugham published 78 books. He wrote for 3 or 4 hours every morning, setting himself a daily requirement of 1,000 to 1,500 words. He would get a start on the day's work before he even sat down at his desk, thinking of the first two sentences he wanted to write while soaking in the bath. Then, once at work, there was little to distract him. Maugham believed that it was impossible to write while looking at a view, so his desk always faced a blank wall. When he wrapped up his morning's work at about noon, Maugham often felt impatient to begin again. When you're writing, when you're creating a character, it's with you constantly. You're preoccupied with it. It's alive, he said, adding that when you cut that out of your life, it's a rather lonely life. And one of the most quoted writers nowadays, with all that's going on in the world, we hear the phrase Orwellian times, George Orwell. Wow, didn't realize he passed on pretty young. He lived 1903 to 1950. In 1934, Orwell found himself in a typical bind for an aspiring young writer. Despite having published his first book the year before, the generally well-received Down and Out in Paris and London, Orwell couldn't support himself on his writing alone. But the lowly teaching jobs he had been holding left him little time to write and put him on the margins of literary society. Luckily, Orwell's Aunt Nellie found him an attractive alternative, a part-time assistant job at a London secondhand bookshop. The post at Book Lovers' Corner proved an ideal fit for the 31-year-old bachelor. Waking at 7, Orwell went to open the shop at 8:45 and stayed there for an hour. Then he had free time until 2, when he would return to the shop and work until 6:30. This left him almost 4.5 hours of writing time in the morning and early afternoon, which, conveniently, were the times that he was most mentally alert. And with his writing behind him, he could happily yawn through the long afternoons in the shop and look forward to free time in the evening, spent sauntering around the neighborhood or later hovering over a new purchase, a small gas stove known as the Bachelor Griller, which could grill, boil, and fry, and that allowed Orwell to modestly entertain guests at his small flat. That sounds like the precursor to the George Foreman grill, the Bachelor Griller. Okay, now we're going to get some other types of artists in here. Got filmmaker Ingmar Bergman, 1918 to 2007. Do you know what movie making is? Bergman asked in a 1964 interview. 8 hours of hard work each day to get 3 minutes of film, and during those 8 hours there are maybe only 10 or 12 minutes, if you're lucky, of real creation. And maybe they don't come. Then you have to gear yourself up for another 8 hours and pray you're going to get your good 10 minutes this time. But movie making for Bergman was also writing scripts, which he also did in his home on the remote island of Faroe, Sweden. There he followed essentially the same schedule for decades, up at 8, writing from 9 until noon, then an austere meal. He constantly eats the same lunch, the actress Bebe Anderson remembered. It doesn't change. It's some kind of whipped sour milk. Very fat and strawberry jam, very sweet, a strange kind of baby food he eats with cornflakes. After lunch, Bergman worked again from 1 to 3, then slept for an hour. In the late afternoon, he went for a walk or took the ferry to a neighboring island to pick up the newspapers and the mail. In the evening, he read, saw friends, screened a movie from his large collection, or watched TV. He was particularly fond of Dallas. I never use drugs or alcohol, Bergman said. The most I drink is a glass of wine, and that makes me incredibly happy. Music was also absolutely necessary for him, and Bergman enjoyed everything from Bach to the Rolling Stones. As he got older, he had trouble sleeping, never managing more than 4 or 5 hours a night, which made shooting films arduous. But even after he retired from filmmaking in 1982, Bergman continued to make television movies, direct plays and operas, and write plays, novels, and a memoir. "I have been working all the time," he said, "and it's like a flood going through the landscape of your soul. It's good because it takes away a lot. It's cleansing. If I hadn't been at work all the time, I would have been a lunatic." And Federico Fellini, 1920-93. The Italian filmmaker claimed he was unable to sleep for more than 3 hours at a time. In 1977 interview, he described his morning routine. "I'm up at 6 in the morning. I walk around the house, open windows, poke around boxes, move books from here to there. For years, I've been trying to make myself a decent cup of coffee, but it's not one of my specialties. I go downstairs, outside, as soon as possible. By 7, I'm on the telephone. I'm scrupulous about choosing who it's safe to wake at 7 in the morning without their getting insulted. For some, I perform a real service, a wake-up service. They become used to my waking them at 7 or so." Fellini wrote for newspapers as a young man, but he found that his temperament was better suited to the movies. He liked the sociability of the filmmaking process. "A writer can do everything by himself, but he needs discipline," he said. "He has to get up at 7 in the morning and be alone in a room with a white sheet of paper. I am too much of a Vitaloni loafer to do that. I think I have chosen the best medium of expression for myself. I love the very precious combination of work and living together that filmmaking offers." And another writer who I had never heard of, her stuff is quite interesting, Patricia Highsmith. She lived from 1921 to 1995. The author of such psychological thrillers as Strangers on a Train and The Talented Mr. Ripley was, in person, as solitary and misanthropic as some of her heroes. Writing was less a source of pleasure for her than a compulsion, without which she was miserable. "There is no real life except in working, that is to say, in the imagination," she wrote in her journal. Fortunately, Highsmith was rarely short of inspiration. She had ideas, she said, like rats have orgasms. Highsmith wrote daily, usually for 3 or 4 hours in the morning, completing 2,000 words on a good day. The biographer Andrew Wilson records her methods. Her favorite technique to ease herself into the right frame of mind for work was to sit on her bed, surrounded by cigarettes, ashtray, matches, a mug of coffee, a donut, and an accompanying saucer of sugar. She had to avoid any sense of discipline and make the act of writing as pleasurable as possible. Her position, she noted, would be almost fetal, and indeed her intention was to create, she said, a womb of her own. Highsmith was also in the habit of having a stiff drink before she started to write, not to perk her up, William Wilson notes, but to reduce her energy levels, which veered toward the manic. In her later years, as she became a hardened drinker with a high tolerance, she kept a bottle of vodka by her bedside, reaching for it as soon as she woke and marking the bottle to set her limit for the day. Now, that's a kind of writer's discipline, make note of there. She was also a chain smoker for most of her life, going through a pack of Galoises, a day. In matters of food, she was indifferent. One acquaintance remembered that she only ever ate American bacon, fried eggs, and cereal, all at odd times of the day. Ill at ease around most people, she had an unusually intense connection with animals, particularly cats, but also snails, which she bred at home. Highsmith was inspired to keep the gastropods as pets when she saw a pair at a fish market locked in a strange embrace. She later told a radio interviewer that they give me a sort of tranquility. She eventually housed 300 snails in her garden in Suffolk, England, and once arrived at a London cocktail party carrying a gigantic handbag that contained a head of lettuce and 100 snails, her companions for the evening, she said. When she later moved to France, Highsmith had to get around the prohibition against bringing live snails into the country, so she smuggled them in, making multiple trips across the border with 6 to 10 of the creatures hidden under each breast. Oh, man, that's probably the quirkiest one I've read in here so far. I have seen in the summer and autumn out on the patio, there are snails that I think they are mating. They entwine like the caduceus, and it is quite a sight. They sort of hang by this gelatinous thread, and it is quite a writhing enterprise. A couple of visual artists, Matisse and Miró. Juan Miró, 1893-1983. Miró always maintained a rigidly inflexible daily routine, both because he disliked being distracted from his work and because he feared slipping back into the severe depression that had afflicted him as a young man, before he discovered painting. To help prevent a relapse, his routine always included vigorous exercise, boxing in Paris, jumping rope and Swedish gymnastics at a Barcelona gym, and running on the beach and swimming at Mont Réaug, a seaside village where his family owned a farmhouse, to which Miró returned nearly every summer to escape city life and recharge his creative energies. In Miró, The Life of a Passion, Louis Permanyer describes the artist's routine in the early 1930s when he was living in Barcelona with his wife and young daughter. At 6 o'clock, he got up, washed, and had coffee and a few slices of bread for breakfast. At 7, he went into the studio and worked nonstop until 12, when he stopped to do an hour of energetic exercise like boxing or running. At 1 o'clock, he sat down for a frugal but well-prepared lunch, which he finished off with a coffee and 3 cigarettes, neither more nor less. Then he practiced his Mediterranean yoga, a nap, but for just 5 minutes. At 2, he would receive a friend, deal with business matters, or write letters. At 3, he returned to the studio, where he stayed until dinner time at 8 o'clock. After dinner, he would read for a while or listen to music. Miró hated for this routine to be interrupted by social or cultural events. As he told an American journalist, "Merde! I absolutely detest all openings and parties. They're commercial, political, and everybody talks too much. They get on my tits." Those are all exclamation pointed. And let's see. Henri Matisse, 1869 to 1954. "Basically, I enjoy everything. I am never bored," Matisse told a visitor in 1941 during a tour of his studio in the south of France. After showing his guest his working space, his cages full of exotic birds, and his conservatory stocked with tropical plants, giant pumpkins, and Chinese statuettes, Matisse talked about his work habits. "Do you understand? Now I am never bored for over 50 years. I have not stopped working for an instant from 9 o'clock to noon, first sitting. I have lunch, then I have a little nap, and take up my brushes again at 2 in the afternoon until the evening. You won't believe me. On Sundays I have to tell all sorts of tales to the models. I promise them that it's the last time I will ever beg them to come and pose on that day. Naturally, I pay them double. Finally, when I sense that they are not convinced, I promise them a day off during the week. But Monsieur Matisse," one of them answered me, "this has been going on for months, and I have never had one afternoon off. Poor things, they don't understand. Nevertheless, I can't sacrifice my Sundays for them merely because they have boyfriends." Yeah, let's see. Do one more here. Benjamin Franklin, 1706 to 1790. In his autobiography, Franklin famously outlined a scheme to achieve, quote, "moral perfection." According to a 13-week plan, each week was devoted to a particular virtue: temperance, cleanliness, moderation, etc. And his offenses against these virtues were tracked on a calendar. Franklin thought if he could maintain his devotion to one virtue for an entire week, it would become a habit. Then he could move on to the next virtue. Successfully making fewer and fewer offenses indicated on the calendar by a black mark until he had completely reformed himself and would thereafter need only occasional bouts of moral maintenance. Reading that, I suppose, writers, for example, could take on a different topic a week, whether it's, practicing metaphors or vocabulary or stream of consciousness or what have you. The plan worked up to a point. After following the course several times in a row, he found it necessary to go through just one course in a year, and then one every few years. But the virtue, "let all your things have their places, let each part of your business have its time," appears to have eluded his grasp. Franklin was not naturally inclined to keep his papers and other possessions organized, and he found the effort so vexing that he almost quit in frustration. Moreover, the demands of his printing business meant that he couldn't always follow the exacting daily timetable that he set for himself. That ideal schedule, also recorded in Franklin's little book of virtues, looked like this. And then there's a picture of the book. Morning, noon, afternoon, evening, night, work, read, work, put things in their places, wash and address powerful goodness. Interesting. This timetable was formulated before Franklin adopted a favorite habit of his in later years, his daily air bath. At the time, baths in cold water were considered a tonic, but Franklin believed the cold was too much of a shock to the system. He wrote in a letter, "I have found it much more agreeable to my constitution to bathe in another element. I mean cold air. With this view, I rise early almost every morning and sit in my chamber without any clothes whatever, half an hour or an hour, according to the season, either reading or writing. This practice is not in the least painful, but on the contrary agreeable, and if I return to bed afterwards, before I dress myself, as sometimes happens, I make a supplement to my night's rest of 1 or 2 hours of the most pleasing sleep that can be imagined." No, you get a sense of all the quirks and disciplines and non-disciplines. And again, that's the moral I get from this is, you know, there is no right way to do it, but just, you know, to find a way that works for you. And then, you know, either stick to it, or if it's flexible, however it works. So this has tons of people in here. It's even got ambient musician Steve Reich, James Joyce, Kafka, Rachmaninoff, Nabokov, Richard Wright, Truman Capote, on and on and on. Charles Darwin. Quite interesting. Well, let's see. I want to read, since I'm big into ambient music, I want to read Steve Reich. He's born 1936. I'm not really a morning person, the American composer said recently. I would say, if you look at everything I've ever written, 95% of it would have been written between 12 noon and 12 midnight. Reich uses the hours before noon to exercise, pray, eat breakfast, and make business phone calls to London, where his European agent is based. Then, once he settles down in front of the piano or the computer, he'll aim for a few good chunks of concentrated work over the next 12 hours. If I can get in a couple hours of work, then I just have to have a cup of tea, or I have to run an errand to get a little bit of a break, he says. And then I come back. But those can be very fruitful pauses, especially if there's a little problem that comes up. The best thing to do is just leave it and put your mind somewhere else. And not always, but often, the solution to that problem will bubble up spontaneously. Or at least a possible solution which will either prove to be true or false. Reich doesn't believe in waiting for inspiration to strike, but he does believe that certain pieces are more inspired than others, and that with continual work you can look forward to hitting these patches of inspiration from time to time. There are no rules, he says. One has to be open to the reality, and it's a very wonderful reality that the next piece is going to hold some surprises for you. And another one I totally agree with is the, you know, sometimes just leave it and put your mind elsewhere. That's, I kind of joke that I have attention deficit disorder, but if I'm starting to work and, you know, 10 minutes into it, I just hit something I can't do, or it doesn't seem to be going anywhere. It's, you know, get up, go wash some dishes, go outside, have a drink, this or that, whatever. But a lot of times that distraction, and then, you know, it keeps things moving, it keeps the flow of life going, and then, you know, a lot of times get back to it, and then it does answer the question. But when totally engrossed in something, then I have the ability to sit for long stretches of time. So it really depends on the you know, what is happening with the process, and when the muse grabs you, you gotta ride it. The moose, as my friend Jim Green used to say. And I think in the context of school education, I think that trying to force creativity in a, you know, like a 50-minute class, I mean, you can, it's a good place to start and you can learn for it, but I think that it doesn't allow for the you know, the freedom of what a lot of these artists describe as, it's a process of, you know, working and non-working. So I think that's part of finding a kind of yin-yang approach to life and the arts that is often drummed out of people in the workaholic educational 24/7 system. So I think we need more breathing room. Artists need time. The way the indigenous people mention now that this phrase Pachacuti, that the earth needs to rest. The earth is in a period of where it's taken so much abuse and so much, you know, mining, extraction, that the earth literally needs to rest and heal itself so that it can continue to provide for us in the best way. So I think that metaphor with the arts and with life is helpful. And a little plug, this book is quite interesting, and also All Book Books has a book, Modern Muses, How Artists Become Inspired. The premise there is that the nine muses that cover different aspects of creativity and expression, different artists, from writers, musicians, painter, playwright, etc., give their take. They're similar to this book, but a little bit longer and more personal, direct, from some of their experience, you know, it's mixed in with poetry and some lots of quotes and helpful hints. So anyhow, thank you again for listening, and have a good one.
And we'll go out with two selections played by Alicia de la Rocha from Granada Scoyescas. First heard this on the radio and it just really stirred me, and then became the music that often I've used when doing brush calligraphy. Just kind of put me in the mood, and it's a little bit of background music and yet very emotive. And these particular selections have a wonderful refrain that just I find very stirring. So oftentimes an artist has, can use music as a kind of theme song or background or get you in the mood.